We know what you're thinking. I just want jeans that look great, feel great, and hold up. At Ariat, we've been doing some thinking too. We're thinking about fit that moves with you, no matter where the ride takes you. Durability that stands up to hard work, harder play, and comfort that never quits. And all this thinking, it's really just about more living. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat jeans at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
You're listening to Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast, the podcast edition. I'm here on Love Sport Radio every weekday morning at 6:30. Jimmy Carter is alongside me. Morning, Jim.
Good morning, Ian.
Morning, how are you, mate?
Very good, very good, thank you.
Good. It's tracksuits, leisure wear, I suppose, I would say, or leisure, as the Americans would say. Do you feel more comfortable in that stuff? As an ex-footballer, is that sort of stuff that you wear now all the time?
Not really. I mean, it's an early morning start. I didn't want to sort of start rumbling around in the wardrobe, getting suits on and shirts and what
suits.
Have you. So,
I'm in a full morning suit. I don't know if people realise this, that I wear a full morning suit every morning. Because I feel one has to maintain standards, you know?
Yeah.
And then Jimmy turns up looking like he's just about to go on the training pitch for a couple of hours. Yeah. No, it's just because I get my clothes ready the night before, you see.
Yeah.
I lay it all out because I'm slightly OCD when it comes to this stuff. But obviously, you're like, no, I'll get up at 4:30, rummage about, grab the first thing. I'm not criticising.
Well, in actual fact, you say that. I actually got my stuff ready last night as
you
well.
You did?
But I got my leisure wear sorted out from last night because I thought, you know what? I've got a little bit of a walk to the train station. I'll amalgamate the morning show with a little bit of fitness as well. So I have a little jog to the station in the morning.
Did you?
Yeah. And then when I get off at Blackfriars, I'm the same again. So, it works. It works both ways.
Right. I see people jogging. By the way, I mean, the studio listener is in Blackfriars. And I get out about 6 o'clock and there's people jogging.
Yes.
There are people jogging. None of them look happy. They don't.
They don't. You've
got to do something.
You've got to do something, yeah.
No. I agree you've got to do something, but I'm not sure you've got to do it at 6 o'clock in the bleeding morning.
Well, it was beautiful this morning. The sun was up, getting up at Blackfriars. It was just beautiful looking across the Thames. As you say, a few joggers around. I was one of them. Not at Blackfriars, but the other end at Potts Bar. So,
right.
How far
do you in the morning?
No, it's not far. It's 10 minutes. So instead of walking, I might as well get a little bit of fitness going.
You might as well jog.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got trainers and you've got the leisure wear.
I've got the full kit.
Full gear. Right. Okay. Well, fair enough. If it works. I've suddenly started wearing a bit of leisure wear. I've been doing Pilates. Did I tell you this?
You have, yes.
Yeah. I did a bit of Pilates. And you need stretchy trousers. You can't be doing that in jeans. You can't be doing it in jeans.
No,
it's very important that you have movement, ample space to move about in.
Yeah.
And so I started wearing them. And the thing is, the last time I wore them was about 15 years ago. Now this stuff has changed. This leisure wear stuff has changed a lot
It has moved on.
It's different fabrics. It's much nicer, isn't it? And I started wearing it.
Yeah.
And I thought, do you know, it's quite comfy.
Yeah.
It is quite.
So are you trying to say that? Out of Pilates, you start wearing it in the street as well.
A couple of times, I've worn it when I didn't need to wear it,
right.
And I didn't feel as underdressed as I thought I would. I was surprised at how I thought, actually. Because I always saw it, it's different for you because you're an athlete, right? Mm-hmm. And you played football and it was basically what you wore.
Mm-hmm.
That was what you wore. Did you wear jeans at home?
It was difficult. I mean, obviously, during the playing career, It felt right to go out in a tracksuit, and we were sponsored as well. So
yeah,
I mean, I think at the time I was with Lotto, so they'd send you loads of gear as well.
Do
you remember Lotto?
No, I don't. No.
Really?
All right.
They were top. They were
nice
top,
gear.
They were top drawer.
Yeah, but more to the point, they sent you loads.
Sent you loads of gear, so you were rocking up in tracksuits to training.
Yeah.
And inevitably you'd finish training at 1 o'clock or half 12, and you'd be in the same sort of gear. So
Andy, our producer, has just typed on my screen. Lotto is classic. It is classic.
Gear. Italian firm. I mean, I used to wear the boots. The boots were fantastic.
Right.
The Lotto leisure wear was quite colourful. So there was a lot of bright colours. It was sort of very sort of psychedelic.
But, I'm going to look it up. I've got the internet in front of me. It contains all human knowledge. I'm going to have a look at Lotto leisurewear in a second. But you see, that's the thing, because I always wore trousers, right, or jeans and a shirt or a T-shirt. That was always, and I always felt, and I've said this before, I always felt that wearing tracksuit trousers was essentially me letting go, going, all right, you're done. You're done. If the body wants to expand, you go ahead and expand, right? These are elasticated. You have a lot of space in them. But I'm not like that, right? But that's,
You're in good shape.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But the thing is, part of that is always that thing that I need to get into the jeans that I've always worn, right? That's what it is. Lately, I had a hernia operation about 15 years ago, and I had to wear elasticated trousers for about 2 weeks. I didn't want to leave the house. I mean, I just didn't want to go out wearing them, right? But anyway, I think I'm over that now. Now I'm actually thinking, it's quite comfortable. Quite comfortable. I mean, this morning, jeans and a T-shirt, right? And I'm and proper shoes, right? And none of those trainers things. But... I'm not as anti it as I used, and I'm not saying you wear what you want, right? But I'm not as anti as I used to be. That's the point. I feel a bit more, I don't know, a bit more at peace with myself.
Well, you seem to be like coming from sort of the old school where, you know, a gentleman would always wear a pair of shoes. And I'm sort of like that as well. But I think it's nice to put on a little pair of tracksuit bottoms, a pair of trainers.
But you grew up with it. That's the point. Didn't really. Listen, we are going to talk about the sport at some point this morning. There have been a few things going on, but I just wanted to get the leisure wear thing sorted out, okay? Jimmy looking resplendent. Is it matching?
It's not really.
It's not matching?
No, it's not matching at all. You've got some Nike bottoms, Adidas trainers.
Right. So it's all over the place. Basically,
and Adidas top. So
because it's only casual in here, right? We can wear what we want.
Of course.
Is it like on like if women are just going to work, they just wear like different. They might not wear matching bra and knickers. I'm told.
And then you got to feel comfortable.
I'm told you got to feel comfy. That is the main thing. Comfort becomes much more of a thing.
Comfort's
as you
key.
Get as you get to a certain age.
This is Love Sport.
England play the Netherlands this morning. I'm still tempted to call it Holland, but it's the Netherlands, isn't it now?
I think officially it is.
It is the Netherlands. Anyway, England play Holland, whatever it is, tonight at 7:45. Nations League second semi final. First one last night. I watched Portugal play Switzerland, and Ronaldo missed a really good chance about 15-20 minutes in. Doesn't affect him, though. I mean, I guess the guy's got bags of confidence.
He's just incredible, isn't he? He's a world-class player, as we know.
53 hat-tricks.
53 hat-tricks?
53.
Gosh.
I mean, it's insane.
I never even scored one hat-trick in my career.
Emil Heskey was on the telly last night saying, how many did you get? Emil Heskey, right? It was a striker.
Yep.
One.
Top player. He got one hat-trick.
One hat-trick, yeah. One hat-trick. Ronaldo's got 53.
Wow.
It's a nonsense. And the finishes, I mean, the first one was a free kick, but the... And that was a good free kick, but Sommer sort of put his weight on his right leg, and that was that. As soon as he does that, he's gone. The other two, I mean, just beautiful.
The other two, you know, at 1-1 as well, two late goals. I mean, I think the first one was 87, 88. His second goal, 88th minute. But what a strike. Comes across him. And they're difficult ones to hit as well when they're coming at you. He's got his foot round it. He's tucked it in the bottom corner. It's a fantastic strike to put his side 2-1 up.
He made it look much easier than it was. I was sort of watching it.
Exactly.
Bernardo Silva pulled the ball back. And he's a fantastic player right? I mean, they've got some players.
Yeah.
Bernardo Silva pulled the ball back, and next thing, it was in the net. At speed, and there's no one else really can do that like him. I mean, he's just a fabulous player. And then the third one,
he did
his little step over, double step over, he's got his space, and then goal.
Well, that's what he's all about, isn't he? Once he gets into the box, you know, he can go either way, you know, because some players want to take it on their favourite foot. He is predominantly stronger on his right foot, but he can go the other way.
We've seen
him score goals with his left foot when he does that little shimmy, takes it on his left foot, bangs in the bottom corner.
Doesn't make a huge amount of difference to him, does it?
No,
really?
No, he's just strong in every single aspect.
So,
great in the air as well, but great hat trick.
Yeah, great player. 53 hat tricks, and he will be a danger to whoever gets in a final. Now England play Netherlands tonight. I mean, there's been a little bit of a argument or something about Raheem Sterling. His PR company basically said that he would be captain, and he then wakes up to this story and goes, what? No one's talked to me. So he has to basically phone Gareth Southgate and go, listen, boss, I don't know what happened. I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, listen, it's a minor irritation, right? He'll wake up, he'll go, what the hell's that? Phone up the PR, phone up the company, phone up Gareth Southgate.
Yeah.
And then he will phone up the PR company and go, do not do that again. Otherwise, there are probably 15 PR companies waiting to take his account, right?
Yeah.
Because Raheem Sterling is excellent PR, let's be fair.
He certainly is. And let's face it, it's a bizarre one, isn't it? I mean, come on. You know, you wake up in the morning, you know, it's a big game, semi-final of the Nations Cup. And, you know, it's he didn't really need that, did he, waking up this morning? It'd be a little bit embarrassing. I mean, what his PR company are doing, releasing that type of statement, is beyond me. And yeah, I mean, as the papers say, you know, Raheem's had to ring up Gareth Southgate, which Gareth would be absolutely fine with it. He knows that sometimes things get leaked, so it's just an irritation, isn't it? On the eve of a very important game.
Yeah, I mean, he phoned his agent, and then. And then he saw Gareth Southgate down the hallway and apologised to him for what happened, right? It was a press release circulated on Tuesday evening suggesting that he could he would lead the country on the occasion of his 50th cap. Now, he probably will. I mean, possible.
Well, that's the ironic thing. I mean, he could well lead his country tonight, but, that, you know, he didn't want it coming out on the eve. And, you know, you'd rather sort of it happen in a different way and come out in the right way. But, yeah, you'd have to say, what is his PR company doing?
So what years did you play? So you played pre and post the start of the Premier League, right?
Yeah, so I made my league debut for Millwall in 1987, and then obviously went to Liverpool in 91, but then went on to play in the Premier League with Arsenal 91 to 95. I was there, then went to Portsmouth. So, yeah, Premier League was 92, wasn't it?
Yeah, around that time. So you're pre the Premier League and then the Premier League, right?
Premier
now,
League,
obviously know that the Premier League, there was a lot more money and all the rest of it, but how many people did you have working for you at any one time? I mean,
I mean, listen, in terms of that, I mean, I had my agent, who at the time was Frank McClintock, and actually had famous double-winning captain in 71. So, fantastic guy, Frank. But that was it, you know?
No PR.
So no team around me as such. But that's how times have changed, though. You know, even on the bench back then, you had your manager, assistant manager, your physio, maybe your club doctor, and a couple of subs. You look at the benches now.
It's not just the benches, the staff. Arsenal, Arsenal, just one club. Yeah. They used to have about 100 people working for them. Now there's about 700 or 800 working for the club.
Incredible.
And obviously this goes all the way through. So you had an agent.
Yep.
An agent, and that was it.
That was it. I mean, it wasn't a team of
PR.
No PR, nothing like that. It was but that's, like I say, that's how the game's moved on since then.
But do you think it's too much? Do you think they're surrounded by too many people going, "Yes, mate. Yes, of course we will, mate. Yes, boss." Do you think there's too much of that?
There is an element of that, but it's just the way that the game's gone, Ian. It really has. I mean, you look at the social media. I mean, that plays a big part of it. So, you know, there's different facets of media now. It's, you know, there's Instagram, there's Twitter, there's Facebook. So the likes of Raheem Sterling and all these top players, they've probably got one individual or a couple of people that actually work on different
facets. Run those accounts.
Different social media accounts.
No, I'm sure that is the case. In terms of the game itself, there's been a bit of trouble in Portugal. Gareth Southgate made a video, didn't he, saying, don't be that idiot.
Yeah.
And obviously that idiot didn't read it.
That idiot and his mates have turned up in Portugal. So,
but England fans, mate. I mean, not all of them. We know it's not all of them, but I've travelled with England. I've seen England games away and I've seen trouble kick off.
Yeah.
And there is always an element. I mean, we're still singing songs about the IRA. I mean, it's 22 years since the Northern Ireland peace process, and they're still singing songs about the IRA. You know, no surrender and stuff like that. And you go, well, I'm not sure this is going to change anytime soon. It's nice that Gareth Southgate made the video. Unfortunately, the people who are interested in causing this trouble don't really give a monkey's what the England manager thinks.
Well, that's the thing, and it is a minority. We have to stress that. And most England fans will go out there, to these tournaments and want to go and watch a good game of football. But there's this element.
Still, a couple of hundred of them.
Exactly.
Racist bigots, most of them.
It's disgusting. And you know, you think that the likes of Gareth Southgate in a little bit of a campaign before to say, you know, come on, you know, it's about time we eradicated that.
Behave.
Just go and behave yourself.
Yeah, look at the fun you can have. Just look how good we are now. Yeah. Right, we've got a young team, multiracial team, and being followed by a small element, and you're right, of racists, essentially, which is a bit strange, isn't it?
And in this day and age, you know, we don't need that at all. And how we combat that, you know, there's got them guys who caused trouble last night in you know, throwing bottles at police and that. They've got to be, for me, sent home. They've got to be eradicated from the game. Total ban on, you know.
I mean, it's better than it used to be. It's definitely better than it used to be. Well, I mean, God, when you were playing, I mean, you know, gangs of hooligans following teams about. And I was, you know, I was there. I was there watching some of this on the periphery, if I'm totally honest.
Yeah.
I've seen it. Never actually threw a punch in anger. Actually, no. I got surrounded by 7 Wolverhampton Wanderers fans on a piece of waste ground outside Molineux. Right. I tried to hit one. And because there were 7 of them, and they hit me. And one of them goes, go on, hit him. Go on, hit him.
Right.
And in this accent. And I started laughing, right? Because I'd never heard of a ridiculous accent in my life. And they were actually punching me, going, why is he laughing? And I'm just going, listen to yourselves. I didn't actually say that, right? But that's certainly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Sorry, Andy, I know they sounded like you. But they were 17. I was 17 years old at the time.
Really?
But that was in self-defence.
Of course.
But these idiots still follow England about. Some of these are grown-up men. Yeah. And they're all men, by the way. All of them.
Yeah.
These are grown-ups.
Grown-up men, they've probably, you know, got relationships, families, and
jobs.
Probably decent jobs off them as well. So you just wonder why. You know, is it the booze? But, I mean, come on, you can...
it's the booze.
That doesn't help, does it?
Yeah.
You know, but you can't close all the bars.
No. You know, it's stupidity. It's stupidity.
Yeah.
It's nationalistic bigotry, hatred of foreigners, and they think, right, we'll go along to a town square in where are they, in Portugal, right? And they're in it was Guimarães in Porto, right? And they go to Porto and they drape a St. George's Cross over the town square, and they sing rude songs about Portugal. I'm not quite sure what there is to be rude about Portugal, particularly. Yeah. It seems like a nice enough country.
Well, it's an indictment on the country as well, because it's an embarrassment, isn't it? We don't want to pick the papers up in the morning and keep reading about hooliganism. You know, it doesn't put our country in the best light, does it?
It doesn't, and do you know what? One hopes that the reports are truthful in terms of what actually happened. What I do remember is being in Copenhagen one time when Arsenal played Galatasaray in the 2000 UEFA Cup final.
Yep.
And I was in Copenhagen, and we got beat on penalties. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit of trouble. Mm. But the next morning we managed to get the English papers, and the report said, as I sit in the wreckage of the town square in Copenhagen, and we were sitting in the town square in Copenhagen, and it wasn't a wreckage. We were sitting there having a latte, going, this is really nice, isn't it? It's a day like today. So I do wonder about the reporting.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely do. But at the same time, this sort of stuff, I'm just sick of talking about it, aren't you? And then we've seen these stories in the papers, and we'll talk more about this, about Wilfred Zaha getting called a monkey at every game. And getting called the N-word.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, and these are the same people,
so
by the way. These are the same people who would cause trouble at England games, I'm telling you now.
They've got to be dug out, Ian. They really have. And be banned. Total bans. It can't be that hard to identify these people.
You would hope not.
You know, CCTV and other players, there's initiatives now in football grounds whereby, you know, if you're standing close to someone who's dishing out racial abuse, report them. Get a steward over. And then that person's got to be...
Well, hopefully it is more self-police than it used to be. I know people try to do this, but you know what? The other thing to say is, if you're in the crowd, most of these racists are massive. I mean, they're big people.
Mm.
You know, you don't get liberal people who are 6'7". You don't, but you do get massive thugs who are that size.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit more difficult. And stewarding as well. It's not these guys are there to basically show people their seats. They're not there to take on enormous thugs.
This
is Love Sport.
Now, we are just a day away from the Women's World Cup as the world's best teams have all made their way to France for the 24-team tournament. This includes England's women, who head to the tournament ranked third in the world and one of the favourites to be crowned world champions come the 7th of July. Joining us now is the women's football expert and co-host of Love Sport's Women's World Cup show, Ella German. Good morning, Ella.
Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for joining us. This is one of the strongest England squads that we've ever had, isn't it? I mean, are they going to be able to live up to it, do you think?
You're absolutely right. It's definitely one of the strongest squads we've ever had. But I think, given the recent results, we've definitely had a bit of a reality check of whether they can live up to that hype. Obviously, the loss against New Zealand on Saturday, you know, did really tell the players, look, we've got a lot of work to do before we head off to France for our first game against Scotland on Sunday. We've got such a good squad and there's such good depth to it, and we've got our own world superstars who are hopefully going to be making their mark on the world stage this summer, you know, in the likes of Lucy Bronze at right back, likes of Nikita Paris going forward, and of course Sam Kirby, who was nominated for the Ballon d'Or last year. Yeah. We've got that potential, but we need to make sure we're delivering it. And in our recent matches, there's been a lack of cohesion between the players, and that's something that we need to get right before we play Scotland on Sunday.
Yeah,
great stuff. Just going to ask, actually. Obviously, the tournament kicks off tomorrow. England don't play until Sunday. England-Scotland games always massive, aren't they? You know, in the men's teams, and this is a massive first game. How important is it for England to start well against Scotland, the rivals?
It's so important because I think our group is one of the toughest groups out there.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's us, Scotland, Japan and Argentina.
Yeah.
Japan have won the World Cup before in 2011, and with the rise of Scotland, they're becoming ever more a threat. Usually, I'd say, you know, in a World Cup, it's not absolutely vital to win your first game to go on and win the tournament. You don't know what could happen. But I think in this group, for us to create a gulf between us and Scotland, who are, you know, competing with to get through to the later stages, we absolutely do need to win. It's also really important that we win the group. I think if we come second, we're looking at the likes of Canada or the Netherlands in the last 16.
Yeah.
Obviously, Canada, a huge women's football side. The Netherlands are the reigning Euro 2017 champions. We definitely don't want to get one of those.
No.
So it's a must-win game for us, but Scotland are certainly going to make it very difficult.
Does Phil Neville know his best team, do you think?
I don't know. He says he does. He says that he knows he's going to be playing in all of the group games, but it's so hard to tell what he's going to do. From the game against Denmark 2 Saturdays ago and the game last Saturday against New Zealand, he made 10 changes. It was only Nikita Paris that kept a place in the side. He said on the recent BBC One documentary that he has this philosophy that all of his 23 players have earned their place in the squad, and he wants to reward them by giving them their chance to shine, which, to an extent, I really like, but he's mixing it up so much that I don't think anyone knows what he's going to do on Sunday. I really don't.
No, as long as he does. I suppose that's the main thing, really. I mean, there's various things. Why is Lucy Bronze playing in midfield?
So this is a really difficult one. She's an incredible player, and she definitely has the versatility to be able to go into that position. But for me, I think why are we saying someone who has made their name as one of the best right-backs in the world in a different position? I think if she's proved herself to be so good there, won trophies in that position for Lyon, why are we putting her in midfield? We've got plenty of very talented midfielders in the likes of Jill Scott, Kira Walsh, Lucy Samator. Sadly, we would also have the likes of Jordan Nobbs and Izzy Christensen in the mix if they weren't injured for the tournament. So we've already got a bit of a problem in picking a midfield. Why complicate that even more? But I think on the plus side, if we were hit with a lot of midfield injuries, Lucy Bonge could step in, which is great, but I wouldn't be starting her there. I'd be starting her at right back for sure.
I mean, there's a couple. I think with these tournaments, it's all about the personalities as well. And there's obviously some amazing players playing for some of the other teams as well. I watch a bit of Arsenal ladies, and Vivian Miedema looks like a hell of a player. I mean, she scored loads of great goals this year. Is there a couple of others that you think we should look out for?
Yeah, absolutely. Along with Miedema, there's a lot of big goal scorers at this year's tournament. We've got the likes of Sam Kerr for Australia. There's been a lot of talk about her really making her name on the world stage. I think she's won back-to-back golden boots down in the league in Australia. She's very well known for her backflip celebrations. So if you turn the TV on and someone's doing that, you know that Sam Kerr's got one in the net for Australia. Also the likes of Eugenie Le Sommer for France. I think she'll be vital for them this year. She's got something ridiculous like 163 goals and 175 appearances for Lyon, and she is a goal machine, and she's another one to look out for. And of course, there's the likes of Alex Morgan for the States. She's got over 100 goals for her country, so there's certainly a lot of players who are going to be in the running for that golden boot prize and who we should be keeping an eye on.
Good stuff. Ella, obviously a lot of expectation, I think, this time around for looking at England going into this tournament. How important do you think, you know, or pivotal was that game against New Zealand? You know, you want to go in with the best preparation. You know, getting beat against New Zealand wasn't ideal. I mean, they're quite low down in terms of the rankings. Do you fully expect England to be, you know, right on point come the tournament on Sunday?
Yeah, I hope so. Like, you're absolutely right. We shouldn't be losing to teams like New Zealand with them lower down the rankings and us in third. We have the potential to do so much better. But I think what Karen Carney said after the game is absolutely right. She said it's not the worst thing in the world if we lose a game going into the tournament, because it is that reality check. You know, I think it's quite dangerous to go into a tournament with the mindset of getting carried away with that hype and thinking, oh yeah, we're going to be fine, we're going to breeze through the group. I think it's quite a good thing, to be honest, that they will really be working hard now to rectify that against Scotland.
Yeah, they will.
Also, at the last World Cup, we lost our last game before the tournament against Canada, and we ended up knocking about in the later stages on home soil. So hopefully that proves that it shouldn't be much to worry about.
Well, hopefully it'll be good. I mean, it's the women's game generally. I was watching an advert. There was an advert with a young mascot with a lot of the stars of the women's game, and Alex Scott as manager of Barcelona. This stuff is all in a positive, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not only going to be the biggest tournament yet on the pitch, but also off of it.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've got the likes of that Nike advert, and you know, at the moment, every time I go on social media, there is so much content coming out. There's so many articles, so many podcasts, all building up to the tournament tomorrow. And I think there's really never been a better time to get into women's football. The amount of coverage there is compared to the last tournament 4 years ago, or even the Euros 2 years ago, is absolutely unbelievable. I think it's come such a long way, and it's such an exciting time to get involved.
Yeah, and the entertainment will be tremendous. I mean, I watched the USA-Canada game, I think it was in the last World Cup. It's one of the best games of football I've seen, full stop, the 3-2. So I'm looking forward to it. One other question before I let you go, Ella. The size of the goals, there's been discussions about whether the goals should be smaller. What's the general view in the game?
I think most people do not want the goals to be smaller. And I completely agree. I think Carly Telford, Chelsea and England goalkeeper, has come out and said the same thing. And I don't think we need to do that, because that's just lending itself to arguments that women's football is not as good as the men's and everything that all the cynics and, you know, social media warriors come out and say. I think that's the completely wrong approach. You know, there are some shots out there that I don't think most goalkeepers probably aren't going to get if it's a shot perfectly placed in the top corner. I don't think the size of the goals is what we need to be worrying about. I think we need to be looking at goalkeeping coaching from the grassroots to the top to improve the standard of goalkeeping in the women's game.
Totally agree.
Cool, Ella. And let's have a prediction. Who's going to win it?
Ooh. Come on, Ella. What are you thinking?
Ella, we've got your recorder running right now.
I really, really want to say England, but I don't want to curse it because I'll blame myself for it if it doesn't happen. So I'm going to go a France-England final, and then France the host to come out on top.
We're getting to the final. We're getting to the final.
Hey, listen, the Love Sport Women's World Cup show is tomorrow between 7 and 8. Friday's between 7 and 8, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
Thanks, Ella. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you.
Enjoy the tournament. Ella German there, who's covering the Women's World Cup. starts tomorrow. The Love Sport Women's World Cup show, 7 and 8. First game tomorrow between between France and South Korea.
South Korea.
So, and France are big favourites, aren't they? France are England, and yeah, so they're certainly up there.
Yep.
France-England final is what Ella's saying. But I think that's, I don't know about the smaller goals as well. I mean, I understand that women just, they're just not as big as men. And you think the goalkeepers now, I think what's interesting is when you played, the goalkeepers, there would have been goalkeepers under 6 foot, right?
Yeah.
Not many, but there were some. There was a guy who played for Ipswich who was about, I don't know, 5 foot ten, something like Cooper. Do you remember him? Tiny bloke. Yes. Tiny bloke.
Yeah.
Now, no one, goals are enormous. No one's saying, the goalkeepers are enormous. Yeah. No one's saying make the goals bigger because these guys are so big. So why would they say make the goals smaller for the... For the ladies' team.
Yeah, I just think that would be a bad move. And as Ella said there, I think it would be a backward step. I think, and it's sort of a kick in the teeth, really, for the women's game, which is in real sort of buoyant mood.
It's in a good place at the moment.
It's in a great place. And I think that definitely, for me, is going to be a backward step. And you ask any women's goalkeeper, and they wouldn't want that.
This is Love Sport.
Breakfast on Love Sport Radio. I'm going to put my jacket on at this point because I'm freezing again, but we'll sort that out in a short while.
It's the aircon, isn't it?
It's the aircon. It's not easy to get the correct. It goes hot, it goes cold.
Yeah.
There's about a millimetre on the dial where it's the correct temperature. Other than that, it's not very good. Now, a slightly depressing story this morning. Wolf Zaha interviewed in the paper saying that he gets racist abuse every game he plays. He gets the N-word at him. He gets called a monkey. Mm-hmm. He gets all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, social media is a big part of this. I'm sure people shout it out as well, although it's getting more difficult to do that at football grounds. Sorry, when I say that, it sounds like I'm trying, but it's just not happening for me at football grounds. It's not what I mean. It means that it is people will see you, they'll film you on camera phones, and you'll get banned. Yeah. Now, I'm assuming you got stick when you played. I'm assuming you got racist abuse.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, my skin's a little bit darker than most people. My father was Indian, born and bred.
I never knew that. Where?
Northern India. Right. So he's from a place called Lucknow in Northern India.
Been there.
You've been to Lucknow?
I've been.
Come
to
on.
Lucknow. No, it's not. It's, you
seriously.
Know, well,
I haven't. I haven't.
I've been. Yes, I saw your father. He said, "Where is he?" I never see Jimmy.
Yeah, he didn't actually.
I tell you what happened. I didn't actually go. I didn't. Well, I went through Lucknow. I was on the train.
Oh, you went through.
And we stopped at Lucknow, right? And I had a berth, like a second class berth.
Right.
So I was asleep. It's amazing. This is so funny. I was asleep, and then as we pulled into Lucknow station, I'm so half awake. I look out the window. It's Lucknow, right? Well, I'm not waking up. I'd never even heard of this place.
Yes.
Four blokes got on and sat down on the edge of my bed, and I'm like, "What are you doing? Get off my!" I kicked them off the bed.
That's
right?
Quite random, isn't it?
It was a little bit random. Yeah. Yes, in the birthplace of your dad. So I have actually been to Lucknow.
Yeah.
Anyway. So you, right, so you're mixed race,
so,
right?
It's a mixed race, yeah. My father came to this country in his early 20s, so he was orphaned at 14, went into the Indian Navy at 16,
wow.
Sailed the seas, was a boxer at 39 fights, undefeated, comes to the
is that
UK.
Right?
Yeah, comes to the UK and marries an English girl. It didn't quite work out. I had two boys, myself and my brother. So he brought us up from little kids in Hackney all by himself. And very dark skinned, my father. And obviously because my mum was English, I was darker than most. So going away to grounds, I think majority of people, you know, supporters probably just thought that I had one too many sunbeds, you know, with the name Carter. Wouldn't necessarily associate me with being Asian, which is fair play. You'd expect that.
I mean, you were the first Asian player to play.
I was the first Asian player to play in the Premier League. Yeah, which was always nice.
Well, there was a real sort of, I mean, people used to say, oh, you know, there's black players, but there's no Asian players coming through. What was, I mean, Carter then was not, what was the your dad's surname?
Yeah, Carter. So my
it
dad's,
was.
So my dad was of a race called quite a minority race, which is the Anglo-Indian race. So what it goes back into like the 17th century. So I've looked at my family tree. So it starts off with Abel Marmaduke Carter. I mean, That's an incredible name to start off with. So he was
got lucky he didn't get that name.
Yeah, so he was from England. He gets headhunted to go to India in the 17th century. He then marries an Indian lady, and it was quite prevalent at the times that this was happening, and that's when the Anglo-Indian race sort of sprung up.
Based in Lucknow and in that area?
All over India. Abel Marmaduke was a pioneer. That was it.
So when you played, did you tell anyone here? Did you tell anyone? Your teammates know?
Well, a few of my teammates knew that I was of Indian descent because, for example, when I was at Millwall, I played alongside Teddy Sheringham. Teddy and I played for the same Sunday side at 13 years old. So he was from Chingford, I was from Hackney, and we played for this really, really top team that came out of Leytonstone. Now and again, my dad would rock up on the touchline. So, you know, my teammates around that sort of era sort of knew. And
your dad is dark-skinned?
Dark-skinned. He's no longer with us, unfortunately, yeah. Passed away in 2009. But, yeah, very, very, very dark-skinned. Not a light-skinned Asian guy. Quite dark.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, he was very, very strict. So we had an Asian upbringing, an Indian upbringing, if you like, me and my brother. So we were in essence, we were Indian kids growing up in Hackney, in inner city London.
So was it easier not to say when you were playing football? Was it just easier not to get into that? Because then you become sort of a subject of interest and perhaps you just want to get on with your career.
Do you know what, Ian? It was one of them whereby, you know, it wasn't a conscious decision to withhold the, you know, that or you know, to say I wasn't Indian. If I got asked, you know, I was half Indian, and that was it. But I guess with the name Carter, you know, it wasn't really brought up that much. For me, playing football was an absolute dream just growing up, and I was a little street urchin playing in the streets, just dreaming of one day pulling the shirt on. So for me, it wasn't a big deal to come out and actually make a statement to say, oh, you know, I'm you know, making my way in football, and I'm an Asian guy. You know, for me, football goes
just
beyond
a young guy.
It's just a young guy, and it goes beyond that, doesn't it? So, yeah. But now finishing playing, you know, I was interviewed by the Daily Mail actually back in October 18, and the fella Joe Bernstein that actually interviewed me was a guy that done one of my first exclusive interviews when he was at the Hackney Gazette, and we just got talking. He had the microphone on, you know, the recorder on, and we just got talking for 2 hours, and it just transpired that it came out that, you know, we started speaking about my father, and he put it a sort of an exclusive, if you like, you know, that I was the first Asian player to Premier League, which is always nice to be the first, isn't it?
Well, yeah, quite. But do you regret at all not saying it now, like from the perspective now? Because I'm thinking about how much more of a trailblazer you could have been if people would have known. And this is not a criticism. It's absolutely your life and you do what you want to do.
Yes.
But just in terms of the fact that you're going, if somebody says, oh, there's no Asian players in the Premier League, and you might have heard that when you were playing, and you're thinking, actually, there is. Look at my old man.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a hot topic, so it wasn't on the radar, so it wasn't that platform for me to then respond and go, oh, by the way, here I am.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, you know, perhaps looking back, it would have been great to have done that, and maybe it would have, you know, created a little bit of a pathway for Asian players, Indian, you know, boys in around to come through.
There still aren't many, are there? Let's be fair. You look at Chowdhury at Leicester, right, and how well he's doing.
Yeah.
But there aren't many Asian players playing, are there? Let's be fair.
But you know what? Historically, and what it's about, and it comes down for me,
it comes down to
the parents. Now, when I say that, is most Indian parents they see football, a football career, as a very, very insecure path. And let's get it right, 0.001% or whatever, that is the case.
Yeah.
So for them as parents, and any logical parents, why would I want my son to go in when, you know, to sacrifice everything, to commit everything to get let go at 16 and for him to be on a scrap heap?
When he could be a doctor.
Well, it could be a doctor, a lawyer, you know. So that's why they haven't encouraged or supported their children to follow the path of football. I was very lucky. My dad, as I said before,
he liked his football.
He loved his sport. He loved his boxing. He loved sport. So we were all about sport.
Yeah.
So I had a totally different upbringing. He was all about, you know, one day James, you know, call me James, Jimmy Carr, but you know, I was James
was
to him.
James at home.
James at home. James, you know, I want to see your name in lights, and you know, when you're older,
cool.
and you know, and I just wanted to make him proud. And for me, you know, he supported and encouraged me, and it was quite a harsh upbringing. I mean, I remember one occasion where 6 o'clock, you know, more than one occasion, should I say, you know, bitterly cold winter, dark, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, it ripped the covers off me. All right, go and run around Clissold Park in Hackney. Dad, it's pitch black. 6 o'clock. Why? Why do you want me to? Well, all your district, because I play for Hackney District. All your district colleagues or teammates, they're wrapped up in bed now. Go and get one over them and get a little bit more, you know, in the tank. And I also always did it. Always, I never cut the corner. Always run around twice around Clissold Park, and you know, maybe that was the difference. I don't know.
Now you're running in Potter's Bar at 5 in the morning. Well done.
This is Love Sport.
Yeah, we've been speaking this morning. Yeah, about the bad side of football. We've just been speaking about the racism issues. Wilf Zaha continues to get racist abuse. There's also been a bit of football violence out there out in Portugal as well. The England fans have kicked off yet again. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's not just England fans who do this. We know the Dutch fans have got a reputation for this. There's been various fan groups got trouble. The Russian fans, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the end, it is getting better. Certainly when you played, 80s, 90s, there was more trouble then than there is now. We didn't have all-seater stadiums. There was a lot. It was dangerous sometimes.
It was a dangerous, yeah, absolutely. And England fans back then, of course, we had it domestically within the English game. And certainly whenever England travelled away, you always felt that there was going to be trouble. Times have changed and things have moved on. It's got a lot better, as you quite rightly say, Ian. But disappointing last night, because obviously there was a campaign that which Gareth Southgate got involved in and mentioned about that, and said, listen, guys, come on, let's just behave yourself when you're
gone. And you think about the England team now and the positivity we got last summer from what happened in the World Cup when and you know. And it's funny, actually, because I saw Jordan Henderson interviewed a couple of days after the Champions League final, and he was talking about the connection between the team and the fans, and we see it. We see what Klopp has done. I think it, more than Man City, more than Spurs, more than anyone,
totally
Klopp
agree.
And Liverpool, what he's done. Yeah. And Henderson was interesting because he said, the thing is, he said, we know the fans are having a great time.
Mm.
We see the videos.
Mm.
We see what's going on.
Yeah.
And you saw last summer during the World Cup, you saw the England team. I remember watching a video of Dele Alli. Now, I'm no Dele Alli fan in a club sense because he's a Tottenham player and I'm an Arsenal boy, right?
Yeah.
But I saw Dele Alli watching these videos of the England fans going crazy after winning a game. And the smile on his face, and you could see him thinking, look at the joy that we're spreading, you know, and how cool it was. We all felt, this is what we want. This, you know, the team playing well and everyone just having a great time. And what we definitely don't want is what is going on. I mean, we're going to be talking to Don Betts, who's an England fan and Love Sport reporter, travels with England. And we're going to have a chat with him later in the show.
Yeah.
But it is depressing when you hear stories like this. You think, no, this is not,
it's not
what it should be.
It's not what we want to see at all. Ian. And like you say, we've made great strides over the years to eradicate a lot of the hooliganism and all the sort of loutish behaviour. And let's face it, it was really embarrassing, you know, when back in the day when we would go on holiday, you know, us, you know, and to other countries and you'd have people coming up to you and go, oh, yeah, you're England fans. And they'd mention it. So it was an embarrassment. It was a blight on the country.
And we've still got an element. I mean, there were four blokes the other day. I was reading a newspaper story about four guys the other day on a plane to Vegas behaved so badly on a stag do, the plane had to be diverted.
Yeah.
So it does go, can you imagine being stuck on that plane with him? And it does,
gosh, no.
I know,
not
it's
great.
Awful.
No.
And it does go on. We know that. But we'd like to think, with the England team being so progressive, so multicultural and multiracial, you think about where their families have come from all over, and they've come together, all English boys now, and they're playing for us, and we love them, and we really did enjoy them. And then to see the trouble that these guys caused in last night, it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah, you just wonder what their mindset is. I mean, you know, gosh, you know, just go out and enjoy the football. I know when they go across to and it's a summer and they want to have a few beers, but you can do that in the right manner. You know, you haven't got to get off your head and start making trouble and start. I mean, last night throwing bottles at the police, and it's just something that we don't need.
Did you see the when the police baton charged them and the locals were cheering the police on? Well, which is, you know, of course they are, because yes. they live in this town and suddenly in this city, and suddenly these people turn up and start causing trouble.
Yeah.
Andy, talking of trouble, Andy has come in. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning.
Morning. Now, what have you got for us?
All sorts of back page stuff.
Have you? Okay.
Have you ever been taunted by your kids?
Sorry?
Regularly.
Have you ever been taunted by your kids?
Yes.
Oh,
all
well,
the time.
Even the greats. Lionel Messi reveals his own son taunts him over Barcelona defeat to Liverpool. This is obviously where they threw away a 3-goal lead in the first leg, lost 4-0 at Anfield. His son taunts him by declaring, "I'm Liverpool," whenever the pair play football together in the back garden. I assume that's a big back garden as well.
I imagine it's an enormous back garden. How funny. Yeah. I like that Lionel Messi. You know what? Yeah. Isn't that good? That Lionel Messi, obviously superstar, venerated, is a footballing god. The greatest we've ever seen.
Absolutely.
And he gets in and his son is trolling him as he gets in. As he's walked through the door and he's gone, oh, and his son's gone, loser, loser, Lionel.
Yeah.
I mean, that's beautiful, isn't it?
And that,
by the way, is what children are for.
It's fantastic.
To bring you right down to earth.
The fact that he's a Liverpool supporter now as well, it's brilliant. And it's a great story.
My kid, Alexander, who is going to be doing work experience here at some point in the next few months, when he... we were messing about. We were just wrestling on the bed or something. And he said something. I don't know what it was. He's like 7, 8 years old. He said something to me and I went, "Oh my God, you're like a little version of me." And he goes, "Yeah, but I'm not a loser."
It's a bit harsh, eh?
I know. And I went, oh! And he looked at me and you could see he thought, "Have I pushed it too hard here?" Right? And I went, "Now look. I know that you're joking. I know that is sophisticated and I understand I've taught you well, but don't do that to other people because you'll upset them." All right. That's the point. Bless him. And then we had him adopted. So that's good.
Fair enough. You've got a spare.
You can't mess about with these kids. They only get one chance and he's done. And I hope he's doing well. What else have you got?
Speaking of abuse, all sorts of talk of Matty De Ligt, the Ajax centre-half, going to Man United. Is he going to Barcelona? Talks about him earlier on in the show. Barcelona senior figure, as sources have quoted in Spanish press, saying if he goes to Man United instead of Barcelona, it will, with the state they're in, it's not far off picking the Chinese league career-wise, such as the state of Manchester United. It'd be sacrificing development and ambition for money in the same way.
Yes,
quite a go.
It's interesting.
I think that's probably right, isn't it?
Well, listen, Man United are in transition. It's clear to see that Solskjaer's got a lot of work on his hands with recruitment this summer. So, listen, he's got a point. Barcelona, more settled, if you like. Probably.
Are they more settled? They're going to lose Lionel Messi in a couple of years.
Yeah, but he's still got a couple of years, isn't he? And they're still a top side, and you've got to say...
Yeah, OK. They're going to lose Busquets. They're going to lose Lionel Messi. They're going to lose, I don't know, probably one or two others as well. PK.
There's talk about Coutinho maybe going to Chelsea as well, wasn't there? So, I mean,
they are going to lose a few. Coutinho can't go to Chelsea. They've got this transfer ban, haven't they? But you know what? I mean, on the other hand, he will earn more at Manchester United. He'll play in the Premier League, which is obviously an amazing league to play in. More competitive, perhaps. And maybe, listen, I think that anyone looking just at the two clubs right now would go Barcelona over, but I think that's a little bit harsh.
So.
I think that's a bit harsh.
They're not quite the standard of the Chinese league left. Yeah, but it is worth, you know, you don't learn anything from who clubs are linked to, but back in the day, even 3-4 years ago, they were signing the huge players and the huge players that had improved the squad rather than huge players that be a burden.
Manchester United.
Yeah, Manchester United. And now they're sort of linked with players from the Championship. Daniel James from Swansea, who is obviously a very good player, very quick.
Yeah, he is a good
player. But he's perhaps a little bit of a downgrade on what they might have bought 1 or 2 years ago.
Well, Europa League football, I mean, they can offer the wages, United, but they can't really, they can't offer Champions League at the moment. And looking at the squad, unless they build quickly, it's possible they won't be able to offer Champions League for quite a few years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. So I don't know.
I think they're going to have to offload a few. I think Lukaku's been linked with,
Inter
Milan, is it? Yes. 65, 70, 70 million.
They'll get rid of a few. Pogba's been linked with Juventus again. It's possible he'll go.
They're going to get a
rebuild.
Few quid in.
Yeah. Big rebuild.
Big.
But De Ligt is exactly the sort of player that would work brilliantly for them because, you know what? Mm. He's going to get plenty of chances to look good playing for Man United, isn't he? Let's be fair. He'll have plenty of like four midfielders running at him and Chris Smalling next to him. You go, okay, I'll do what I have to do. Yeah, I mean, we'll see how that develops. You got one more?
Talk about Christian Eriksen moving. How much is he going to go? The Tottenham midfielder has only got 1 year left on his contract. Spurs asking for $130 million for a player who's got 1 year left on his contract. Mm-hmm. Surely they're not going to get that. Talk about Real Madrid offering $80 million. Other news briefly as well. De Gea linked again with Paris Saint-Germain. Yes.
I mean, as far as Eriksen is concerned, 1 year left, they are going to sell him. But I think that is a negotiating position. They want to pay $80 million. Spurs want 130. They'll settle on 110, 105, and be done. This sounds essentially like the same conversation that they're having with Chelsea about Eden Hazard as well. But it seems that Eriksen wants to go because he would sign a contract if he didn't.
Spot on. Yeah. Andy. Whenever you hear about Eriksen speak, even in today's papers, he's coming out with the sort of statements whereby he feels he's ready to go.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. It's all about certain negotiation, but I think he will be off this summer.
Yeah, I think he will as well. This is Love Sport. Thanks for listening to the Ian Stone Comedy Breakfast Podcast Edition. I'm back every weekday morning, 6:30.